Welcome to Inside Admission, the podcast that gives you a behind-the-scenes look at the college admission process with the experts in and around college admission.
Welcome to the Inside Admission podcast. I'm your host, Andy Palumbo, and I am thrilled to introduce this week's guest, Ken Anselman, Vice President for Enrollment at Lawrence University, and also one of my favorite podcast hosts. So this is an exciting episode for me. Ken is the host of the Admissions Leadership Podcast, also known as the ALP, one of the hottest podcasts in higher ed, certainly in the admissions world. So it is a special treat for our listeners today. Ken, why don't you introduce yourself and tell the viewers a little bit about your background?
Why should I introduce myself? I mean, you could be my hitman any day. No, it's just saying before we started recording, it's weird. Good weird? Well, we'll see. We'll right, but it's a good weird being kind of on this side of the interview. I'm used to being the one in the driver's seat, so we'll see where this goes. So, introduction. You already nailed it. VP for enrollment at Lawrence, a role I'm going to actually be sunsetting soon. I've been at Lawrence for this is my 18th year, and I think it was when I was signing admission letters for students that were born the year that I got here. I started thinking, well, maybe it is time for that life change, and so I'm going to be joining that team at RHB as their VP for enrollment, starting in the beginning of May. And
it's exciting.
It's bittersweet. I mean, I love Lawrence, but I also really love the folks at RHB, and it's I'm grateful and thankful for the opportunity. Grateful and thankful, basically the same words. Can you tell I've been reading applications? I'm just speaking like I've got a thesaurus in front of me.
Well, that's good prep for today's topic. We're going to dive into how we review applications. So perfect.
Right.
So why don't you, you know, I talked about the ALP a little bit. Why don't you tell viewers, you know, who are looking for a new podcast, tell them what that's all about.
Sure. I could just say, welcome to the ALP. The Admissions Leadership Podcast, a series of one-on-one conversations with people who have been climbing the leadership mountain in college admissions. I won't do the rest, but it's a show where I like to bring in people who I admire, who have been doing really good, important work in this space, and I think we all have things to learn from them. Even those of us who have been doing this for a very long time. And it's been just such a wonderful opportunity to connect with folks, and they've been so vulnerable and open with their stories and how they've gotten where they are and where they've fallen flat on their faces. And I think it's doing what I dreamed it would do when I gave birth to this idea back in the summer of 2019. Which was to really be this place for people who aspire to leadership roles in admissions and enrollment to kind of hear what other folks have gone through to get there and to learn from their mistakes, learn from their wins, and also just hear kindred spirits on the same journey.
Well, you know, the thing I love about it is, while there's some inside baseball, certainly as folks share their stories.
Of course.
It really is about leadership. You know, shows people's humanity, and that's you know, one of the things I guess I'll say I've borrowed from you is really this idea of trying to humanize this work that we do, get people to understand that there are actually human beings, you know, on the other side of this, in that, you know, admissions committee room, or maybe zooming in from their home, as the case may be, the past couple of years. And I think, you know, we've seen during the pandemic, you know, actually, while students couldn't come to our campuses for periods of time, we can go to their high schools. Some of the stuff we've done, you know, online has really brought us closer to students. And so I didn't want to lose that. Yeah. And you know, drew inspiration from your podcast and a couple others. Oh,
well, thank you. I'm happy to hear that. That's good. The more folks that are lifting all of us in the profession, the better, because I don't have to tell you, this is hard and sometimes lonely work.
Absolutely.
And when you realize how many fellow travelers there are that stay awake at night sweating over the same things that we're all sweating through, it suddenly doesn't feel so lonely anymore. And so I think there's strength in numbers. And for me, at least, it's been restorative. And it's fun, like I said, to be here on this side with a fellow traveler, but letting you ask me all the questions. And you can try to make me cry today.
Well, you say that now, but now I'm gonna get real.
Okay,
so
take us back
to your own college search. Let's hear the good, the bad, the ugly. What do you remember about that? Do you remember what you valued in the process, and you know how you went about it?
Yeah, I do, and I wouldn't recommend anybody do it the way I did. I've been trying to, I think, atone for my sins ever since then. So you're asking me to go way back. Man, I mean, this was 1987.
20 years ago.
Yeah, right. It was well into the previous millennium. But I went to an all-boys high school in Milwaukee, Marquette University High School, name drop there. And so I had all the privileges. I had access to great college counseling. I didn't know any better. And yet, despite having all these amazing resources around me, I kind of did it by myself, which was not so great. I basically chose my colleges because they were colleges that my parents liked. And so one of them was a college in South Bend, Indiana. Do you like how I do it pretentiously? It rhymes with floater fame. So growing up Irish and Catholic in the upper Midwest, basically your choices, if you're the firstborn son, are to either be a priest or go to Notre Dame. And so I chose the latter and applied. So I applied to Notre Dame and I applied to Marquette just without really any counseling. Notre Dame was the first college I ever visited. I think I was 7 years old. I visited my cousin and went to a Notre Dame Navy game. And I was like, I don't know what college is about, but this seems really cool. So that was, it was a no-brainer. Got into both places. I think everybody who gets into Notre Dame has to say that, right? Like, I got in. But was confronted with the reality that so many students are today facing, which is, okay, now I got in. How am I going to pay for this? Because that was long before the idea of merit scholarships, I think, were really even invented, or certainly were not as prolific as they are right now. And I remember going I remember when I got into Notre Dame, I drove into the garage or into the driveway, and my family was out playing basketball, which they never do as a family. So my two sisters are out there with my parents and they're shooting buckets. I'm like, that's interesting. And they said, close the garage door. And I did. And they had a sign that said, congratulations, Kenny, Notre Dame class of whatever. So we went down and visited, and I learned that it was going to be a really big financial reach for my family. And my only option there was to join ROTC, which actually had some appeal for me. But I also took a flyer on a scholarship program that you had to apply for at Marquette. And because I overheard about it in an English class from a kid who had just submitted his application. And I submitted mine, like all good boys do, at the very last minute. And luckily enough, got the scholarship, and it turned my head and ended up going to Marquette. And so it was not my first choice. And to make it a little harder, that was the year, that was 1987. So it was 1988 was my first year at Marquette. And that was when they won when Notre Dame won the national championship in football. And I was kicking myself. But after that, never looked back. That's too long of a story, but that's kind of how it went. Other than I had all these great advantages, didn't take as much advantage of them as I should have. But it was, it ended well. It ended well. I ended up working at my alma mater for 12 years after I graduated as part of the indentured servitude program.
It certainly seems as if it went all right for you.
It did.
Ken, now, can you recall, that period after you've submitted your application, you're waiting to log into your portal. Oh, wait, we're going to the mailbox every single day. Wondering why haven't I heard back yet? And it's been 3-4 days. Many of us waited months to hear back our decisions. Do you remember what was going through your mind at that point, or how you felt as admissions officers were deciding your fate?
I didn't think I was going to get into Notre Dame at all. I figured it was a long shot. I figured for sure I would get into Marquette U because I was a kid that went to the prep school just down the street, right? You know, arrogant me. But I don't remember actually going to the mailbox every day to find out, because I was so caught up in basketball season and track season. I figured the college stuff would end up coming my way. Like I just said, I didn't find out I got into Notre Dame until my family had this great reveal. Like it was before like baby reveals and promposals and all that, but it was really special that they did that. But so I imagine, I've never asked her, but my mom was probably going to the mailbox every day on my behalf to check and see if it was a small envelope or a big envelope.
Well, parents are
but I also remember, just to put a time to this, I remember filling out my Marquette application. And it was, you know, I think it was maybe on a 17 by 11 paper that had been, you know, folded, and it was, you know, put in a number 10 envelope. And you had like in an old tax form, like there was a square for every letter in your name, and I had to fill all of that out. And of course, I wanted the penmanship to be perfect and of all course. Of that. But no, I don't remember as much of the anticipation, and thank you for reminding me how old I am and really struggle with my memory right now.
Happy to do that for you, Ken.
Yeah, you're the best.
So I think, you know, the big question families have once they submit that application and they're waiting for that response is, how does it all work? You know, like what's happening in the background there? You know, you mentioned coming off of application season, and you know, this episode, I really want to give people some insight into what that looks and feels like. So, you know, you're here representing Lawrence. Let's start thinking about what is Lawrence looking for in an applicant when you or folks in your team are reviewing an application.
Well, you know, we approach the process and, you know, to be fair, we actually have a couple of different processes because astute listeners or viewers will know that Lawrence has a conservatory of music along with the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. And so every student goes through an application review. But for those who are looking for a music major, they're also going through an audition process and, you know, a music review, looking at musical potential and musicianship. Sure. So when we're reading applications, you know, we're looking for a lot of the same things that most colleges are. I'm lucky that I get to work at a place where we have a bias to yes when we're making decisions. And I'll get back to what I mean by that in a bit. I realized by working at a place, you know, one of the colleges that changed lives, I get to play the role of good guy a lot. Yeah. And I do that at our open house programs and try to demystify what the admission process is like. And I know you like to do that as well. So for us, it's trying to assess, okay, does the student have the academic chops to do what we're going to ask them to do? What kind of writers are they? They don't have to be perfect. You know, what sort of activities are they involved with and so on. We're not really comparing students to each other at Lawrence. We're really comparing them against whether we feel like they've got the qualifications to do the really hard work it's going to take to be successful at our school. And so whether it's an emphatic yes or kind of a, okay, we think so, and with some support, they'll be able to do what they need to do to be successful, we'll give them an offer of admission. In the conservatory, it's a little bit different, depending on the studio. We sometimes like to comment that, you know, if you're a female voice, it's one of the most selective processes that you can ever go through because there are so many phenomenal female voices in the world. If, on the other hand, you're a bassoonist, if you can put the instrument together, you're probably a really good candidate for admission. So it'll, ha-ha, conservatory admission joke. But, you know, it'll also vary based on what the studio needs are, who's graduating, and all of that sort of thing. But I talk about, you know, being able to be the good guy. You know, we're admitting over two-thirds of the students that are applying to Lawrence. So we're like most colleges in the country. And I used to kind of sit on a real high horse thinking like, you know, we were doing such a good job and shame on those highly rejective colleges for doing what they're doing. But I've developed some empathy for my colleagues who work at highly selective institutions because I've also had the good fortune of being on the National Merit Scholarship Review Committee for the past few years. And that's a whole different order of magnitude of decision making. You know, you're going through thousands of applications, and your bias has to be to no, because you know you're making offers to, in some cases, 15% of the students that you're reading. So you're actually trying to find the things that disqualify a student from being going on to the next level, and that's harsh because they're all wonderful. And so I have, since being on the National Merit Committee, I have come down a bit from my high horse and realized that we've got hard work no matter what kind of place we're working for. But those highly selective colleges, highly rejective, whatever you want to call them, that's tough, tough, tough work. Not just managing the volume, but knowing that what it represents for the human being whose application sure. that you're reading.
Yeah, and if you could reach out to one of those incredible students who you're having to say no to in that process, what would you say to them?
It's not you, it's us. I don't mean to be flip about it, but it's, you know, there are many other people who have said it way more eloquently than I could. Patrick O'Connor being chief among them. You know, he's mm-hmm. this great champion for students and, you know, the vulnerability that they have to demonstrate going through the process. This is not an indictment of who you are. This is really a function of how many people, wonderful people just like you, want to get into our institution. And if we were bigger and we could accommodate you along with everybody else, we'd love to do that. But we also know that there's a college for everybody. I think there's this notion that you've got to get that brass ring college or the one that looks really cool on the back of a bumper sticker, you're not going to put that on, but a window sticker, or you know, your parents are going to be super excited to tell their friends about. But at the end of the day, you got to find a place that's going to fit well with you, your talents and your aspirations, and give you the things you're going to need to be successful. And the truth is, there are hundreds of colleges that can do that, and most of them you probably haven't even heard of.
That's a great, great point, Ken. So let's move on to how you at Lawrence review an application. And so let's...
Yeah, I realize I didn't answer that question when asked it.
No, we're getting to that. We're getting okay. to that. So let's put the conservatory to the side for now. And
sure.
If there's something that's distinctly unique about the conservatory process, I think that would be interesting for you to add in as well, because I think that
for sure.
we will have some students and parents who are going through either a process like yours or maybe one that's similar.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. You know, you had, according to the Lawrence University fact book, about 3,000 applications for the class of 2021. Mm-hmm. And you had just over 400 students enrolling. And so mm-hmm. while you make the case that, you know, you get to say yes more than you get to say no, how are you reviewing those applications? You know, how does a bill become a law? Take us through that process.
You want me to sing it?
You can sing if you want. Yeah.
Somebody should make a sung version of how an application becomes an admit. I'm just an admit. Yeah. I'll stop there. You know, I know sometimes you like to find out, you know, how do I approach it? What's the first thing I read? And maybe it's a function of my age and how I came up, but I start at the very beginning and I just kind of want to see, okay, where are they from? What's their family look like? Where do they go to school? And then I just kind of follow through on how the Common App does its things, or, you know, if they're applying using Lawrence's app, it's the same. We structure it in exactly the same way. How have they gotten involved? Or where have they gone to high school? Have they gone to multiple schools? Have they done summer schools or any dual enrollment things? I quickly skip past the test score part and want to find out if they've submitted. And Lawrence doesn't require SAT or ACT, and we did it long before the cool kids caught on to the or had to catch on. You know, we went test optional in 2005.
That's great.
And you know, it's we haven't been adrift without it. Like all of our other colleagues, many of our other colleagues, I think, have been discovering, you know, you can still make good decisions without them. But you know, the thing I really like to dive into is what's their life outside the classroom like? How do they write? What's their story? What's the essay about? Letters of recommendation. You know, we could probably do a separate podcast on rec letters. I mean, that's, I think, another place where the inequities in the system really come to a head. You see who's got access to people who can spend a lot of time getting to know them, and students who maybe don't even have that opportunity to them. So, you know, I have yet to read a letter of recommendation that hasn't really recommended the subject of the letter. So there aren't a lot of surprises. And that's not to say that the work that counselors are doing in that is not valuable. It is. It always helps. But I also have to keep in mind that not everybody has access to that sort of support. Right. And so we're looking at that and how well they tell their story. It doesn't have to be perfect. And then Lawrence has a pretty heavy duty writing component to its first 2 years through the first year studies program. So we really do pay close attention to what students' writing chops are like. We also have a supplemental essay question. We think we're super clever with it, which is, you know, I think the question goes, why Lawrence? It's a short question looking for a short answer. 47 words ought to do the trick. And we don't want them to go on and on about how awesome we are. But it's also, we did the 47 because Lawrence was founded in 1847. And it's just kind of a nice little nod. And it's a sharp, pointy number. But even that, you know, what does that answer look like compared to what the essay looks like? Because sometimes you'll see a real difference in the polished prose of the big essay and maybe have something a little different in the purpose-written piece for the institution. But all of that, you get kind of a sense of who the student is. And if the student is a clear admit, we'll put them through for a final decision. So readers are empowered. If a student has green lights all the way across the board, they can go right into final review. And then the dean of admission will sign off on them. But if somebody has maybe had some rough stories in their transcript, I mean, I know people have talked about this too, the shape of the transcript matters. What sort of courses mm-hmm. have you taken? If you're a 3.3 student, has it been a steady 3.3 or is it a sine wave of a 3.3? Have you been a 4-point student and now you've been on a downward trend? You know, so if we need to get more information, we'll ask for that. But if a student doesn't really clear all of their hurdles after first review, then of course they'll go to committee. And committee will be a group of counselors, usually three at a time, who will review the application together and come up with a final decision of whether it's a yes, whether it's a defer for additional materials, straight to waitlist, or a deny.
So I'm curious, sometimes students may find themselves in a little bit of hot water. Maybe they made a mistake mm-hmm. along the way, bad decision, disciplinary mm-hmm. record. How does that show up in the application process? And as you're considering this, what are the things you're trying to figure out as you consider whether or not that may have an impact on a student's admission decision?
Well, that's a good question, and I know that's a thing that can really scare some students if they have something like that on their file. You know, I think almost all of us in the profession are not going to go into the double jeopardy game of punishing somebody again for something that they've already been punished for in sure. their school. However, I mean, the severity of it may have an impact on your admission decision. If for some reason we find out something, you know, plagiarism, I don't want to pass off plagiarism and just say it's not a problem, because academic honesty is something I think we all take very seriously. Sometimes students find themselves in a tough spot and make a bad choice. How'd they learn from it? And how are they ready to go forward? I think it's an if they were taught the lesson well in their schools, and that doesn't always happen, but I think we'll acknowledge it in our decision and know that that's something that we take very seriously here. If we have to get more information from the student, though, we'll invite him for a conversation. We're not a place that requires interviews for admission, but we strongly encourage it for students where there might be some questions about their story. If, on the other hand, this is something that reveals that it could be a threat to community safety, I mean, it's our responsibility as admission officers to make sure we're creating an environment for all of our current students and the students we'll be enrolling to be as safe as possible. You're never going to be 100% on that because you don't know 100% of what's going on. But if you're presented with evidence that suggests that someone might jeopardize your ability to do that for your students, and we take that very seriously. And that'll actually, we just had one of those a couple of weeks ago, where then I'll convene colleagues from student life and other stakeholders on campus, and we'll all take a look at the case together and make a decision.
I appreciate you answering that, because I think that is something that, you know, I think students fear, and, you know, and maybe, it may be, you know, that suspension from sixth grade for, you know,
oh gosh,
pushing your friend in the hallway, or, you know, I think that there's,
who hasn't done that?
There's so much stress and anxiety around this process. I mean, I think it's really helpful to understand that the admissions office is going to great lengths to understand sort of what's happened, you know, how the student is communicating that. And I think the fact that may surprise a lot of people is, you know, our school is the same, and I'm sure there are many others who approach it the same way, is trying to give the benefit of the doubt for students learning and developing, and bringing in colleagues from student life and in other areas of the campus to help make that determination. So I appreciate you giving that answer. I think that's some insight you haven't heard here on the podcast.
And we've got to, as much as we can, and I know you know this, but we've got to also check our bias at the door when we're doing these, making these decisions, as well. A colleague of mine, Dan Hamron, he's our operations director, will often just say, and he's usually saying it about college basketball players, especially the teams that we root for, but he's like, these are kids still trying to figure it out. Right. And I think that's a really helpful mindset. Like, you know, you're right, and I make mistakes. Why should I hold a 17-year-old to a higher standard than myself?
Absolutely.
You know, it's really creating opportunity for learning. So, yeah, we could pontificate about this one all afternoon, but I think we're on the same page on this.
Well, not to take us down too negative a road, but something that's made the news the past 4 or 5 years has been a spate of colleges rescinding offers of admission. After decisions have gone out, very often in the summer, as students are preparing to go to college for maybe behavior, online bullying, some other things that have caused this type of a reaction from schools. What is it that would cause Lawrence to take a second look? I mean, we constantly get the question: if I get a C in AP Physics, am I gonna lose my admission? I think we can all agree the answer to that is certainly not.
Yes.
So please, if you're listening, it's okay. Yeah. We don't want you to tank, but what are the things that would rise to that level of a discussion?
Yeah. Oh man. The risk of sounding like a Supreme Court justice, you know it when you see it. You don't kind of go into it with a threshold and say, well, if a student does this, but you know, even some of the examples you gave in the lead up to the question, bullying, that's going to be, I think, something that's going to require a reckoning, because if someone has a track record of that or is emerging as that, do we want to have that in our community, especially a place that is small? We've got 1500 students and we're 100% residential. So, you know, that could have a corrosive impact on a community. Sure. But the way we approach it, and at least the approach I have taken, was informed actually by one of my bosses when I worked at Marquette, Ray Brown, who would always give students the benefit of the doubt and let them explain themselves. And so the approach that we've been taking at Lawrence for as long as I've been there is, look, we trust there's a perfectly reasonable explanation to explain whatever this is. If it's a serious academic decline, or if it is a suspension, if it is whatever, please give us the explanation, because I think you probably know as well as anybody, folks in college admission have fantastic imaginations. And if you don't tell us what the story is, we're going to come up with a fabulous narrative that's probably not going to do you any favors. So, you know, take control of the story and tell us what happened. Again, we're not looking to shame you. We want to understand what it is. It may mean that we're going to rescind your offer of admission, but we want to understand the nature of what it is. And there's always more to the story. There's always more to the story than what you originally hear. And so we want to make sure we're going through due diligence to give the student the opportunity, and whoever is representing their story, as much of an opportunity to give us the full picture.
That's great. I like that
approach. I should add, we're not cruising everybody's social media accounts to find out what they're doing. Nobody has time.
We don't have the time
for that. I don't know how many, you know, maybe some colleges do hire a bunch of people to crawl the internet and find out what they're doing on TikTok and Snapface and MySpace. And I'm kidding, I'm just trying to sound old there. But, you know, I think very few of us are tracking what's going on in social media. I guess the mantra I would use is something I think I used when I was an RA back in college, which is, don't put me in a position where I'm going to have to make you explain what you're doing.
That is sound advice.
Enjoying the podcast? Find us on the web at insideadmissionpodcast.com. And you can find and engage with us on social media, where our handle is Inside Admission on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Now back to the pod.
So coming back to making the decision. So let's close it out here. Yeah. So it sounds as if at Lawrence, if everything is a green light, you know, that reader can send that right on to the admissions dean for final approval, or it may go to a small committee before, going one way or the other.
That's right.
Now, In a recent episode, I talked to Jay Jacobs, who you had on your show just this week, as we're recording. He talked about the idea of shaping the class, of that admissions dean or director at the end, really looking at the final consistency of the class and shaping. I'm curious, is there shaping at Lawrence? And if so, what are some of the things you look at? I mean, as I did a little bit of more research about Lawrence, you know, I knew a lot about the university, but not really about its student body. I was blown away by the geographic diversity that you have, just the demographic diversity. So it clearly seems as if, Lawrence is a place that champions students from various backgrounds, you know, coming together building upon one another's experiences. Mm-hmm. How does that play out in the admissions process?
Yeah, that's a really good question. We often talk in strategic planning meetings on campus about the difference between shaping a class and filling a class. And, you know, Lawrence is a place that we are, you know, I would love to have 4,000, 5,000 applications a year to some degree. On the other hand, that would probably mean that we're just going to be saying no to more students.
Sure.
As I said at the outset, you know, we're admitting more than 2/3 of the students that are applying. And the ones that aren't, it's not that they're not as good as the other students that we're offering admission to. We just don't think that they're going to be able to be successful at the institution. So to that degree, we probably don't shape a class, maybe like Jay does or like some other more selective institutions. So the part of it for us is really how we recruit a class, where we go to get them. We've got our tendrils out all over the country. Being in the colleges that change lives certainly helps for that. But, you know, we've got students from the Pacific Northwest and Colorado and California and Texas and New York and all over the world. But I think a lot of that's a function of where we have built relationships in the past. And I mean, this is a long windup of saying we're not shaping a class as much as I think the class shapes itself by where they come from and how they choose a place like Lawrence. Again, one of the reasons why I get to play that role of good guy, because most of the students who come to Lawrence in the first place aren't casual applicants. They know what they're getting into, and they know that it's, you know, when you get all the way through to a small liberal arts college, those generally aren't going to be casual applications. You go through a discernment process as a student and look at sort of a basket of schools, I think, that fit with what you're thinking about. So, I mean, we're lucky, not just luck, it's taken a lot of hard work to get there, but to build the applicant pool of students that are really capable of doing the work in the first place. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for bringing us through that, because I think, you know, on online forums and popular media, we're constantly barraged with messages of college admissions decisions don't make any sense anymore. And, you know, it's a coin flip.
Some places.
Who's going to get in, who's not. And it's a minority of places. The vast majority of colleges and universities in the United States operate very similarly to Lawrence. And I think that's a great thing. And I think that, more people should be aware of that, because I think that can help reduce some of the unnecessary stress and anxiety in the process.
One of the things I'm going to miss when I ride off into the sunset, or the sunrise, I should say, but, is to be that person every time I'm in an auditorium or a classroom and I'm in front of students that are just coming into the process, to play a game with them that I learned from Marty O'Connell. who used to be the executive director at Colleges That Change Lives, and is just a wonderful, wonderful human being, and played a big role of helping me learn what liberal arts colleges like Lawrence were all about when I first started. But she would go through and tell a story, something like this. And I do the same sort of story, which is, you know, I'll ask students, all right, there's about 2,000 four-year colleges and universities, not-for-profit in the U.S. What percentage of those colleges do you think admit more than half of their applicants? And it becomes like this auction, right? And it usually starts in the low, low double digits. And then, you know the answer, right? I mean, it's 80%, roughly 80% admit more than half of their students. And I think the average acceptance rate's what, like between 60 and 63%, something like that.
Yep.
According to NACAC's data. But, you know, most people are surprised when they hear that. And Marty would always go on to tell the story, you know, like, because the stories we always hear, always read about, and it's usually in April, is the story of the kid that did everything right. Student body president, captain of the basketball team, valedictorian, took all the AP classes at the school, not satisfied with the AP classes, started teaching their own AP classes for fun and profit for the classmates. Walker of all the dogs in the neighborhood, healer of the sick, inventor of cold fusion, and got shut out at all of their top
didn't get in any
schools, which, yeah, didn't get in anywhere. Those are easy stories to find. And then Maria Furtado, who followed Marty, built on that and would say, Americans love things that scare us. We love scary movies, roller coasters, and stories about college admission. But every time I do it, you can feel the shoulders just drop a little bit and the breath kind of relax. And the message is, look, this is going to go better than the world has led you to believe. Fact of the matter is, most of the drama is on the tail end when students are choosing which of the five colleges they got into is going to be the college that they're going to attend. But that's not the story you're going to hear. Yep. And so every time I get a group, I want to tell that story over and over again to tell them this is going to be fine. It should be fine. If, however, you're that kid who got the perfect score on the SAT and blah, 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 and didn't get in, well, that's probably a function of college choice. As I think, again, Patrick O'Connor, I think, is the one that says, if you apply to 10 schools with a 10% college admission rate, that doesn't now give you a 100% chance of getting into college.
That is very accurate. So, as we talk about things like you mentioned, highly rejective colleges, which is Akil Bello.
Hat tip to Akil. Guest. Yeah, hat tip to Akil.
It's a way of turning this craziness on its head, idea that more selective means better, a lower admit means better. And I think it goes hand in hand with this idea that college admissions is a meritocracy, that the best student should be admitted. Can you talk to this a little bit about, your thoughts on whether or not it is a meritocracy and how would you define best student?
Yeah, I should know the answer to this, but what is the, is there an opposite to a meritocracy?
I'm not sure, but it's whatever we have, right?
Yeah. I mean, sure, I guess, but this concept of what the best student is a unicorn. Sure, the pursuit of being the best, I think, is such a cool American thing to do. And not just American. I know there are plenty of cultures that do the same thing. But I see, this isn't the question that you're asking, but I'm going to rail on this anyway. You know this. I mean, so many of the kids that are coming to our colleges now are out of gas because they're trying to be the best rather than kind of be the best versions of themselves. But they're trying to be this iconic, idealistic, whatever. And it's no wonder we've done this to them. Our system has done this to them. And, they're taking more difficult classes than might be healthy. I'll often say, hey, that's cool. You can take BC calculus, but if math's not your jam, don't. If you really want to take that art class and you're looking at a place like Lawrence, go for it. You don't have to do BC Calc to make us happy. And don't do it for us. Do it for you.
Exactly.
So this concept of the archetypal best, I think it gets us in a lot of trouble. Is it a meritocracy? Yeah, I think because we continue to reward that. I think it's a system that rewards a lot of the same sorts of things that it has always rewarded. And a lot of it goes hand in hand with wealth and privilege, which isn't necessarily meritocracy. that's not always earned by the student. But also there are some wonderful kids who come from wealthy and affluent backgrounds who I think do a great job of acknowledging that and also acknowledging that they still have a lot to learn. And so I don't want to take students that have all the advantages and cast them aside, because I think that's doing the same kind of disservice we do to students who we ignore because they don't have access to the things that maybe those students do. So it's on us. I mean, I think to... be as countercultural as we can. Again, I get to say that working at a place like I do, and I know, I recognize that that can be a little more difficult at places where you have to admit 10% of your applicants because you can't pack that many more into your classrooms. So that's not an answer, Andy, but let me climb down off my soapbox just a second.
Oh, get back up there. I'm teeing you up.
Okay.
So you've just been appointed college admissions czar. You get to redesign the college admissions process from scratch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What does it look like?
Oh, wow. Well, I'll probably cite my source here. I know John Bakkenstedt often talks about the using the matching system, or someday, and recognizing some of the audience for this show, this could be a threat to our work, at least in terms of selecting a class. How much of what we do in the college admission process is because the really, really good schools, the quote, really, really good schools do it? How many colleges really do need letters of recommendation? How many of us really need an essay to make a decision? How many of us really need an interview to make a decision? We went through a process at Lawrence that we didn't see all the way through, which was the Simplify initiative. This was maybe about 7 years ago, which was, let's strip down the entire application process and think about what we really need to make a decision. And, and a lot of it is stuff that students have already done. Lawrence isn't a coalition school, but there's some, I get the concept of the locker, that whatever students are doing in school can form the body of the work. And it's up to us then to figure out how that fits with our institution. But if I am a czar, I would probably look for some really smart yet ethical group of data scientists to help figure out an algorithm that would not only look for students who would get into the institution, I think that's less important, but the kinds of students who thrive in our environment, and give students a basket of colleges that look like the places that they would thrive in based on the things that they want to do and maybe things they don't know they want to do. So it's, maybe it's like Pandora or Spotify or some sort of playlist for colleges, but you get your list of schools that look good for you, and I get a list of schools that look good for me, and I don't have to worry about which one I'm getting into because I know there's six of them that are a good fit for me and they all want me. What would that world look like? It of course would mean that the culture that they graduate into on the other end would also have to change what it values, and not just fall for, oh, you went to X college? Oh, well, they're there. So if I'm an admissions czar, I also have to have the ability to change the entire society into which we'll be graduating our students. Can I flex that, Andy?
Granted. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. I sort of threw you a curveball there, but I think it's really helpful for folks to hear some of the things we grapple with, and some of the things that we ourselves see as, maybe I don't think any of us.
Do I hear little people there in the background?
You do hear little people. We are very authentic here at the Inside Admission Podcast.
That's awesome.
So after 3 o'clock, we have potential special guests left and right. So.
Perfect. That's the best. You mean college applicants starting the really early decision process?
So I think it's funny. You mentioned the fact that, you know, we as college admissions professionals, you know, help perpetuate this, and we do create the system that, you know, perpetuates stress and anxiety among students. And, you know, I heard something from a faculty member when we were having a vote to adopt a test blind admissions pilot for 8 years at WPI, which was successful. Yeah, and well a done. Faculty member stepped up. You know, we had provided all the data that showed, as you know, that, you know, students who don't submit test scores achieve at the same level as students who do. And, you know, we've been test optional for almost a decade. So we had that. We had the, you know, the fact that it aligned with a lot of our institutional values. But the thing that stopped me in my tracks was, you know, professor about my age, you know, late 30s, early 40s. And he said, you know, I have a 5-year-old at home. And this is such an exciting discussion because I just think, imagine if 10, 11 years from now, she doesn't have to worry about this stupid test. And that maybe she can spend that time reading, playing with her friends, literally doing nothing. You know, wouldn't that be a better world?
Being a and kid.
Exactly. And so, I think that that's a lens that I see more and more admissions professionals taking to our work. I think that, you know, far more than a decade ago, you know, I see a lot of college admissions offices really pushing proactively for change. And in some cases, college presidents or faculty themselves coming to the admissions office. And so, you know, I think there is hope for some of the types of things that, you know, you've looked at Lawrence and that many other colleges are looking for. And, you know, to bring it back to your idea of matching and of identifying who would thrive in your environment, I think we really need to move away from the cookie cutter process, which follows the school that's perceived above our institution in the pecking order. And we need to look within ourselves. You know, we need to look at our mission and our values and our goals for the future and select the students that fit that. And I think that, you know, the more we do that, the better the outcomes are for students and the better the outcomes are for our institutions. So any of our colleagues who are listening, mission-centric admissions, you know, it is the way to go.
Yeah, agreed. And well put.
So, you know, I think we're getting close to wrapping here, Ken, but I do like to close out. I know. You don't want to go off and have dinner on a Friday night, right? So I really appreciate you spending so much time with me. This has been
this is fun. A lot of fun. This is fun. Thank you.
So I do like to finish, you know, with just one or two things for students and parents to take away. But before we get to that, you know, is there secret information that you have about college admissions, something that parents and students don't know that you haven't already shared? You've shared a lot. But is there anything out there that you want to share with them that you think would help them navigate this process a little bit better that the average person just might not know?
I don't know if it's a secret. And I think it's just a different flavor of what I've already said. I think it was the Pew Research Group that said there was something like, fewer than 20 colleges in the country that admit less than 10% of its applicants. Maybe I may not be getting the numbers exactly right, but it's sort of like the Pareto principle. They get at least 80% of the news coverage. And that's not going to change. That's not going to change. People want to read about those colleges, and I get it. But you know, I think the secret is not really a secret, or it shouldn't be, is that most students are getting into plenty of colleges. And the other piece is, I think it's the SERP research that typically shows, and I know sometimes there's some bias, you know, you're going to, of course, come to reckoning with your final college choice. But I think the SERP data shows sort of year after year, most students are enrolling in their first choice college.
Yep.
And if you add whether it's their first or second choice college, that number goes up significantly to something like almost, 3/4 of the students that fill out the survey.
Absolutely.
So there is evidence out there that suggests that this does end well for most students. And if you have help in choosing a group of schools that will look for who you are and respect the things that you're interested in and see that there's a place for you in their school, you're going to be great. You're going to go far. And don't worry about what other people think about your college choice, because it's your decision and you get to live that life. It's not a secret. It's more like, and that's one to grow on. But you know, I think that's the secret, which is that most of us are saying yes most of the time.
Yep. So for students listening who may be feverishly compiling that application as a deadline approaches, as someone who sits on the other side and who reviews that application, is there anything you'd tell them as they're preparing to send off that application that they should be thinking about?
Yeah. This will sound cheesy. This will sound like Coach Ken stuff, but we're looking forward to meeting you. Because that's really what it is. It's an opportunity for us to meet each other. You get to rehearse everything you're going to say before you send it to us, but then we get to silently sit back and absorb who you are and learn as much as we can about you. And that's when we the admission readers and decision makers, when we stop and think about what that really represents, it is an honor and a privilege for us to be able to do so. It's hard work. It burns us out. But it really is a privilege that we get to do that so many times for so many people.
Well said. And the final question for parents, we want what's best for our children, but there's
a line.
Speak
for yourself.
There's a line. What would be your do's and your don'ts for parents who are assisting their child through the process?
Do listen to them if they're talking to you. do pay attention to what they really do get excited about. Listen to what their fears are. Listen to your own bias and favorites and how that may play on things. You got to be, of course, realistic about the degree to which you can support your student's interest in a particular college based on the financial aid that school might represent for you. But as long as you can and as much as you can, be an idealistic realist and be a coach for those kids. And when they make their choice, celebrate it, even if it's not the one you really wanted them to go to. I had to work real hard to keep my own biases in check about where I wanted my kids to choose to go. And it turns out they each chose the school without any influence from me, but it wouldn't have mattered what they would have chosen, but they found their way to it, which itself is a phenomenal learning opportunity for them. But it's also a tough transition for parents because it's the beginning of you starting to step back and let them go off and become the adults that you're supposed to let them become in college. So yeah, don't write their essays for them. when you review them for them, make sure that you're reviewing them to make sure that it sounds like them, but not like how you want them to sound. I think sometimes we maybe put our thumbs on the scale a little much and let them be their whole broken selves or whole selves, whatever they are, because that's the person that's going to be enrolling at those schools.
Well, thanks so much, Ken. Do you want to tell folks where they can find the ALP?
Sure. Available on finer podcast platforms everywhere. I don't know why I'm using my sportscaster voice, probably because it's March Madness time. Can we even say that? Do we have to pay royalties for having said that?
I'm not sure. We go rogue here.
the Admissions Leadership Podcast is available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and Stitcher and pretty much anywhere you can find it. We got to get you on the show. We got to do a back crossover so we can pick you up on here as well. I'm wrapping up season five here shortly. What's going to be fun is the final three guests, if I do this right, will be my three bosses I've had in the admission profession.
That is cool.
Season six is coming again in the fall. So we'll be back in touch. But yeah, it's been an honor and a privilege. And I dedicate the podcast. I haven't said it all that often, but Tom Wheat, who was the longtime VP at Butler, he was at Iona. He was kind of the catalyst. His passing was the catalyst for the show. When I started, he helped me start thinking about intergenerational leadership and what we who've been doing this for a while can pass on to the next generation. So that's not what you asked for, but you know how admissions people are. We'll give seven answers to one question.
And one more thing. No, I appreciate you, you sharing that. So, and thank you so much for all that you do for the profession, Ken. And I really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Yeah, this was fun. Thanks for having me. A real pleasure. Keep doing the good work.
Enjoying the podcast? Find us on the web at insideadmissionpodcast.com. And you can find and engage with us on social media, where our handle is Inside Admission, on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.